Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The race between Allison Riggs and Jefferson Griffin for a seat on the North Carolina Supreme Court remains the only undecided race in the nation from last year's November election. After two recounts, incumbent Justice Allison Riggs won the race by 734 votes, but her Republican challenger, Judge Jefferson Griffin, who sits on the State Court of Appeals, continues to challenge the results. The case has gone through many courts since November, with Griffin initially asking for more than 60,000 votes to be thrown out. That number has been substantially reduced over time, and recently the North Carolina Supreme Court gave those who cast those contested ballots 30 days to cure them by providing their IDs, or those ballots would be discarded. That ruling has since been stayed by the federal Fourth Circuit Court. It is a mess. Like so many other things in our politics today, it's also unprecedented. The process has revealed numerous vulnerabilities in our system and has implications for the integrity of this last election as well as future ones. So this hour, we're going to comb through all of this as best we can and examine just what is at stake. We're joined by WFAE political reporter Steve Harrison. Sam Levine is with us. He's the voting rights reporter for The Guardian. And Bob Orr is a former justice for the North Carolina State Supreme Court. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to you all. Thanks for being here. So, Steve, I'm going to start with you. Judge Jefferson Griffin has been contesting the outcome of this race against Allison Riggs since the moment the vote count was released. It was a close vote count. He rightfully asked for recounts and got them. And each time, Allison Riggs had 734 more votes than he did. Just as a matter of comparison, the current Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court won his race against Democrat Sherry Beasley several years ago by 401 votes out of 5.4 million cast. And of course, Sherry Beasley also asked for recounts, but eventually conceded. With Riggs' victory being larger than the Chief Justice's victory, why are we still going through this, Steve?
Excuse me. I think there was a sense of surprise that in what was a very good year for Republicans in North Carolina in 2024, with Trump winning the state by over 3 percentage points, I think Jefferson Griffin was surprised that he lost. You know, he was ahead by 10,000 on election night. The vote is not finished being counted. We still have to count provisional ballots and mail ballots, et cetera. And in the next 2 weeks, that 10,000 vote lead evaporated. And I think there was a sense, I think you can make a connection between what happened in North Carolina and going back to the 2020 presidential election, when the same thing we saw happened in places like Pennsylvania, where Donald Trump was ahead on election night, and then this, you know, so-called red mirage, and then as all the votes are counted, the result changed. And I think probably on Griffin's view, there was a sense that, well, he won this race. I'm not saying that's correct at all, but I think that's probably where some of this comes from, that there's a sense that, you know, Phil Berger, the Senate leader, had said at the end of last year that he was a little discouraged or disappointed by the idea that, quote, we keep counting votes until your side wins, meaning the Democrats. Now, there's no basis for that. But I think that at the heart of that, there's this sense on the GOP side that what happened wasn't fair, when in fact, there's really no evidence to suggest that there were any problems at all.
Sam, you cover this all over the country. I'm sorry, Bob. But Sam, you cover this all over the country. And I'm curious where this is coming from, because very often in previous contests down through the last 20, 30, 40 years, when television began to be the announcer of who wins elections, quite often we didn't have a winner by 10, 11, or even midnight, or even the next morning in some of these races. And quite often the front runner would lose gradually more votes to the person coming up from behind them, and ultimately that second person would win the race. And we took it for granted that that's what happened. Why are we suddenly contesting all of this? Why do we find this to be a surprise?
Well, I think there's no question that what we're seeing in North Carolina is something that we've seen across the country. And it's, you know, especially linked to the 2020 election when there was a prolonged effort to litigate the election by the losing presidential candidate, Donald Trump, in that case, to try and litigate it after the fact with the aim of overturning the results. You know, the Republican Party has embraced this idea that before the election, you can lay the groundwork to claim fraud, raise suspicion about totally normal election practices, and that after the election, you know, especially if the election is close, the like you mentioned, the one in the state Supreme Court contest was remarkably close, you can go to court and try and contest it to try and overturn the election. So there's no doubt that this idea that elections don't end on election day or when, you know, the state election board certifies is definitely something that we're seeing across the country.
Bob, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to amplify what Sam and Steve have said. And you always have to throw at least one good conspiracy theory into any discussion. I think this was a national strategy in case Trump had lost North Carolina by a narrow margin, that the powers that be in the Republican Party and the Trump campaign had lined up the best litigators, a ton of money, and all sorts of theories, so that if needed, say in North Carolina, they would go in and immediately start filing a lawsuit. Trump easily won North Carolina. The governor's race and the AG race weren't close. This is the only race that was there. And I think it was a decision made from Washington. Well, we're already having this teed up to go to court. Let's try it out. They have been willing to put literally, I would say, millions of dollars in legal fees and time into one seat on the North Carolina Supreme Court, which in the greater scheme of things doesn't in any way shift the balance of the court. So I think this is really driven by a national strategy that Sam alluded to across the country to litigate close elections that are unfavorable to your side.
So this, we've had changes in this election and machinations in this election since November, almost on a daily basis, sometimes several times a day. Initially, Judge Griffin requested that more than 60,000 votes be rejected, 62,027 to be exact, Steve. Remind us of why. What problem did he have with those votes?
So the 60,000 or 65,000 were in three buckets of votes. The biggest were this idea that there were roughly 60,000 voters statewide, whose registrations were incomplete. And Griffin alleged that they were missing required information like a driver's license number or the last four digits of a social security number. That was the biggest bucket. The second biggest were a group of overseas and military voters who did not provide photo ID when casting a ballot. And the third were a very small group of roughly 260 so-called never residents, people who have who voted in the North Carolina election, but haven't lived here. And an example of those people would be they were born overseas, perhaps to military families. Their parents are, you know, have North Carolina residency, but they didn't. Those were the three buckets. The biggest group, the state Supreme Court, did say that the roughly 60,000 will count. Yeah. But that still leaves up to 6,000-7,000 people whose votes could potentially be thrown out. And because most of those are from Democratic counties, there are enough votes in there to tip the election to Griffin.
So was it a surprise that the state Supreme Court, which leans Republican by a substantial majority, said that the 60,000 votes could stay in the race? And to be clear, those 60,000 votes were deemed to be valid, correct me if I'm wrong, because they were following the law and a law that's been followed in every election in the state for years. Is that correct?
Was it a surprise? I think there is a sense, so that the Court of Appeals, the three-judge panel, had said that those all, that the all 65,000 were potentially subject to being discarded. I think the state Supreme Court's decision was meant to reclaim a bit of legitimacy for them and saying, well, this is a, quote, mixed ruling. We're keeping most of the ballots. But the key point is, in their ruling, you know, Griffin doesn't need all 60,000 to be thrown out. He just, there are enough votes in the court's ruling for him to still win. So while I think it was a bid for the court, an effort for the court to regain some legitimacy while still keeping the door open for this challenge to win.
So there are a lot of, there's been a lot of movement, and every day it's been different, and the numbers change every day. And we're going to talk about this twisted path that this has taken as we go through the hour. But this week, in its last ruling, the state Supreme Court gave voters who cast the questionable ballots 30 days to provide their ID or their ballots would be discarded. The State Board of Elections reduced the initial, I think, 5,500 or so ballots down to 1,409 votes cast primarily by military and overseas voters, something that Griffin contested because it involved primarily voters in Guilford County and not those in other heavily Democratic counties. But on Tuesday, the Federal Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ordered the State Board of Elections not to send information to overseas or military absentee voters about providing voter ID, which means they put a stay on this, something that was requested by Allison Riggs. Where does that leave us?
Well, let me jump in there. The Griffin legal team has asked the Court of Appeals to intervene, the North Carolina Court of Appeals to intervene against the State Board of Elections decision only to address the absentee ballots from Guilford County, because that was the only county where the Griffin protest had actually listed names. Now, the Griffin campaign says, well, we would have listed these other four heavily Democratic counties, but we didn't have a list of names when the deadline hit. What nobody addresses is, well, what about the other 95 counties in the state where arguably some number of people voted overseas absentee without a photo ID? And in the meantime, as you indicated, Mike, the U.S. Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals has put a stay on everything so that the federal district court can get briefing and arguments on whether, in fact, there are federal issues and that this belongs in federal court.
Steve.
I was just going to piggyback on what Judge Orr said. It is inexplicable to me. I understand that the Griffin campaign mounted its challenges in Democratic counties. He wants to win. I get that. But for the Court of Appeals and the state Supreme Court to say, okay, well, we're only going to require overseas and military voters in Democratic counties to show a photo ID. And as Bob said, let the other 95, 96 counties, all those votes count. I don't understand how the court can get to that point. If it's a problem in Guilford County, if it's a problem in Buncombe County, it stands to reason that overseas and military voters in Mecklenburg and Wake County should also be required to send in a photo ID. But I think the problem with that, I think if you extended this overseas photo ID requirement to all overseas and military voters, I'm not sure that would help Griffin. I mean, I think if you required all of these voters to do that, I think enough votes, he might lose by even more. And I think that's why the court has limited this challenge to these only Democratic counties. It's just mind-boggling.
We have to take a break. I want to explore that a little more deeply, and we'll talk about these votes, whether or not they are illegitimate and why they would be considered so, given the fact that they haven't been considered that way in previous elections, when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about where we stand in the race for a seat on the state Supreme Court between the incumbent Democrat Allison Riggs and Republican challenger Judge Jefferson Griffin, who sits on the State Court of Appeals. Steve Harrison's with us, our WFAE political reporter, Bob Orr, a former justice on the North Carolina State Supreme Court, and Sam Levine is with us, voting rights reporter with The Guardian. Well, you've been covering this since the very beginning, Sam, and I'm just, as we talked about a second ago, how these votes were picked and chosen, it seems like a transparently surgically precise way to choose your voters. Is it anything more than that? Is that how it appears from the 30,000 foot view that you have?
I think that's exactly what it is. I mean, one important thing that I think we can't forget to mention in all of this is that the Griffin campaign, throughout all of this litigation, to my knowledge, has failed to produce a single voter who was actually ineligible to vote. And, you know, I think that it's more about that they're challenging the rules that the North Carolina State Board of Election, North Carolina legislature has set for elections that have long been in place, and they're challenging them after the fact. I mean, there have been clear examples of people who were eligible to vote who have been wrongly challenged. Most notably, I mean, Justice Riggs's parents were challenged as part of this process. And, you know, she cut numerous ads pointing that out, just to point out the absurdity of that. And my colleague and I talked to numerous overseas voters who were challenged in that never resident category that Steve mentioned. And they told us, we are North Carolina residents. We own property there. We live there. We temporarily moved abroad, and we have no idea why we're being challenged as never residents. They think there might have been some administrative mistake, but they're clearly eligible voters. So, you know, like Steve mentioned, I think this is just an effort to pick as many Democratic voters as possible and try and get their votes thrown out.
Plus, these voters were, as best as I can determine from reading through all of this, and maybe you can correct me, Sam, these voters were cast legitimately, at least by the voters themselves, under rules made prior to this election. And had Jefferson Griffin won this election, we, in all likelihood, would not be going through this right now. We don't know what Alison Riggs might have done if the result had been flipped. But this does make Judge Griffin look like a sore loser who wants to win at any cost. So what I'm hearing people say is that this is part of a national strategy. Is this a test case for future elections? If they can make this work here, can we anticipate more of the same in the next 2 years, 4 years?
I think there's no question that we can. You know, I spoke with Justice Riggs a few weeks ago, and she pointed out that before the ruling from the North Carolina Court of Appeals, there had never been a court ruling after an election going back and invalidating votes based on a dispute about the rules. And you know, I think that the problem there is that it really sets a precedent to other people who might try this to say, you know, let's go and try this in another court, in another state court, where we might have justices who are favorable to our argument. So I think there's no question that that we'll see more of this in the years
had,
to come.
Had those original 60,000 plus votes been tossed out and be allowed to be in question, it seems to me, I'm curious as to why they only focused on this race. Had those votes been tossed out, those voters voted in other races, the results of which might have been changed in the absence of those votes. And yet that was never called into question. Sam, do you understand why? That makes no sense to me.
It makes no sense. I mean, to challenge the eligibility of ballots only in a single down ballot contest, but have nothing to say about the results in other elections, just I think gets at the nonsensicalness of this argument. It's a clear effort to target one race in particular, one contest in particular, and to get certain voters' ballots thrown out. It makes no sense.
Bob, have you seen anything like this before, either in this state or elsewhere?
No, absolutely not. And I do think that it's critical to point people to the dissent filed by a very conservative Republican justice on the Supreme Court, Richard Dietz, who really took his Republican colleagues to task in a relatively polite way and said, you know, this is horrible for elections. It is presenting a great danger to the public confidence, and made the point that Sam just articulated, that this has never been done to come in and interfere in an election after the fact, challenging statutes and regulations that had previously been adopted and were in place. And one, it's highly unusual with this court to see the Republican justices split like that. But it was a strongly worded, and I thought one of the most powerful dissents I've read in a while on all of the problems that are going to come out of this, including the potential problems down the road when any candidate, Democrat, Republican, whatever, decides, oh, well, the Purcell rule saying that you can't interfere with elections by challenging statutes after the fact doesn't apply here, and so it's free game. And I really encourage people to track that dissent down and read it. And I have great admiration for Justice Dietz in having done so.
The numbers keep changing, Steve. And correct me if I'm wrong again, but the state Supreme Court's most recent ruling in this case paved the way for as many as 1,675 voters to have their ballots thrown out, which is more than double the margin of victory that Allison Riggs currently has in this race. But I've also read that those ballots would not be enough for Griffin to overcome that 734 vote deficit. Is that correct? Is that right?
So the Court of Appeals ruling and the state Supreme Court was slightly vague in terms of, with this group of overseas and military ballots needing to provide photo ID, it was a little vague in terms of it did not specify specifically which counties the state board needed, were kind of subject to their rule. Griffin has made challenges in six counties. And the State Board of Elections then came back and said, okay, here is how we are going to follow your order. They said, as Bob Orr said earlier, we're going to make this order subject to the 1,409 voters in Guilford County, because that was the one county in which Griffin was able to file his protest properly by the deadline. Griffin has now challenged that and said, no, this needs to be all six Democratic-leaning counties. And if it's just limited to Guilford County and the 1,400 voters there, plus another 260 or so of these never residents, there's probably not enough voters for Griffin to overtake the 734 deficit if it extends to another four or five additional counties. There probably are. I would assume the state courts are going to side with Griffin. I mean, they have given him every opportunity so far to try and win the race. So that's kind of the next step at the state level is determining exactly how many counties are subject to this photo ID rule.
Bob, or you are. Go ahead.
Sorry. Can I just add one thing to what Steve said? Mm-hmm. Sorry to interrupt, but you know, one of the most extraordinary things that the Griffin campaign has asked recently, in my mind, is for those 260 voters who are alleged to be never resident voters. The North Carolina State Board of Elections went to the court and they said, we want to make sure that these people are actually never residents. And our plan is to go back and check their voter files and ensure that actually they've never voted in North Carolina. They've never, you know, showed proof of residence. And we just want to be sure before we take this extraordinary action of retroactively throwing out their votes 5 months after the election, that they are in fact never residents. And the Griffin campaign has objected to that. They are objecting to actually ensuring that these people are ineligible to vote. They say North Carolina State Supreme Court said these votes don't count. you have to throw them out. There's nothing else you can do. So they're being very, very aggressive in trying to throw out votes, you know, 5 months after the election, when there is concrete, publicly reported evidence that many of these never residents are, in fact, totally eligible voters in North Carolina. And I think that's just an extraordinary argument to be making in this context.
Bob, Sam used the term the Griffin campaign made these moves, but at the tip of the spear is Judge Jefferson Griffin himself. I'm sure the campaign would not be doing anything if he said, no, don't do that. So the fact that they're doing this, and it appears to be what Sam says it is, does that not call into, as a former Supreme Court justice, does that not call into question Judge Griffin's judgment and his fitness?
Well, first of all, I think Judge Griffin, while he ultimately has the responsibility as the client in this case, there are also considerations that I think, the National Republican Party and their lawyers are driving this litigation. And, you know, I think this is their strategy, the litigation team strategy, which is being paid from Washington. And, you know, we can disagree with, and I fully agree with Sam's point that not having a process at the Board of Elections to make sure that any voter who's having his ballot potentially thrown out has an opportunity to come in and say that's incorrect, as opposed to this sweeping dumping of votes, is a poor strategy, or certainly questionable strategy. But, you know, I'm not on the inside. I haven't talked to Judge Griffin or any of his legal team about this, but I think, you know, he's along for the ride, and this is being driven by forces way beyond Judge Griffin's own personal self-interest.
Which leads us to politics. Prior to 2018, Bob, as you well know, we elected judges in North Carolina, but we had no idea of their political leanings. There was no D or R behind their names on the ballot as there is today, because in 2018 it became a requirement for candidates running for state court judge or Supreme Court justice to declare their political affiliation. In your opinion, is that what has led us to where we are today? Would this have happened in the absence of voting for judges who are either Democrats or Republicans?
Well, unfortunately, the answer is yes. And all you have to do is look at Wisconsin to see that a, quote, nonpartisan race for the Supreme Court is just as partisan, if not more so, than when the candidates have the labels. But I do think, being an old timer, Mike, the North Carolina state constitution in 1868 provided for the election of judges, and we elected judges and justices in partisan elections from 1868 all the way up to 2004, when the system was changed to ostensibly nonpartisan for about 10 or 12 years. All five statewide races I ran as a partisan candidate. So it certainly colors the landscape by virtue of, you know, the political parties here, and this is a huge subject, but the whole you know, the federal judiciary, the state judiciaries have all been increasingly politicized by the parties, in part because of redistricting issues that the courts have to decide. And it really is, in my opinion, destroying public confidence in the judiciary and damaging any concept of an independent judiciary. That's why I was refreshing. Yeah.
I was going to ask you that question, but now I want to ask you, if, having been a member of the Supreme Court, is that a concern among the justices on that court, that they are helping to politicize what should not be a political body?
You know, I'm sure there is some concern there, but it is a totally inconsistent system to ask an individual to run as a partisan candidate for an office, but once in office, completely disregard partisan affiliation and the people in the party that helped elect you. It is a truly uncomfortable and sometimes almost untenable position that we put these people in.
Well, there's no. Let me ask you this, because at the federal level, we don't elect judges. They are appointed, but they are appointed by politicians, and they are generally appointed by politicians who look for people of their political stripe to put in those positions. Is one system better than, worse than the other, or are they exactly the same?
I think in 2025, there might as well be the same, because what we see at the federal level with nominations and confirmation hearings is the, you know, trying to stake out the nominee on where do they stand on all the hot button issues of the day. You're not going to be nominated or confirmed if you don't check all the right boxes. And I think this is a phenomena that probably started back with Robert Bork's confirmation hearing back, what, some 30-something years ago. But yeah, the federal judiciary is being politicized, even though it's an appointment system, just as badly as the electoral system here in North Carolina is politicized.
So Jefferson Griffin is a judge on the State Court of Appeals. Clearly, he knows the law. Is his request to disqualify voters who complied with the laws that were in place prior to this last election, is that a stretch legally, Bob?
Yeah, I think so, because I fully agree with Justice Dietz that the Purcell Doctrine applies, that you don't change or challenge an election based upon laws and regulations that were in place during the election. And Justice Dietz is very pointed in that, and I agree with him. On the other hand, Judge Griffin's legal team thinks that that shouldn't be the law or isn't the law in North Carolina.
And as we have found over the last several years, the law is certainly open to interpretation. When we come back, we'll talk about the implications of all of this and the calculus on both sides of not backing down. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Our New South. This Charlotte-based Levine Museum podcast explores today's South through social, political, and cultural topics in their historical context, featuring conversations with locals driving change. Our New South is available on all podcast platforms.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Allison Riggs-Jefferson Griffin race for a seat on the state Supreme Court and where it stands today and the implications of all of the wrangling that we've been enduring since the November election. It remains the last undecided race in the country from that election. Steve Harrison is with us. He's WFAE's political reporter. Bob Orr is a former justice on the state Supreme Court. And Sam Levine is a voting rights reporter for The Guardian, who has been covering this since the very beginning of it. And we've talked about how this is kind of there's a roadmap for what's going on right now that was probably concocted should Donald Trump have lost North Carolina. And they're using that map to try to see what they can do with the outcome of this race. You, Sam, spoke to Justice Allison Riggs about this, and she told you, quote, "This is not just a North Carolina problem. This is an existential threat to democracy." And she says that she worries, quote, "This is honing a playbook to be used in the future, that people in power hold on to power by selectively challenging election outcomes that they don't like. This could impact both Democrats and Republicans in future elections." The Democrats are fighting this tooth and nail. Have any Republicans expressed concerns about the precedent this could set?
Well, I think Judge Orr mentioned that a Republican justice on the North Carolina Supreme Court, Justice Dietz, wrote a very meaningful dissent calling out his colleagues for what they were doing. I saw former Governor Pat McCrory has also spoken out, criticizing the Griffin effort. Basically, he said, I wanted Jefferson Griffin to win. I wanted the Republican candidate to win, and he lost. And, in a democracy, we have hard-fought elections. We have very close elections. But, they end at some point, and you pack up and you start working on the next one. And maybe, in 8 years, you get another shot at that, North Carolina Supreme Court seat, or, whenever the next election is, and you try again. That's how things work in a democracy. This idea that here we are on April 24th, still talking about an election that took place at the beginning of November, I think is very corrosive to the idea of democracy. And I think, regardless of the outcome in this case, even if Judge Riggs, ultimately is seated, which would be the correct outcome is the outcome that should occur, you think about the damage that it does to belief in the state Supreme Court, the power that it has. If North Carolina voters don't see her as a legitimately elected justice, that really undermines the authority and the power of all of the rulings that that come from the court. So I think it's a very, very dangerous thing and a very, very corrosive idea to democracy.
And the same would be true if they didn't trust the outcome and Judge Griffin was put in that seat on the state Supreme Court. And we have what a lot of people have characterized as threats to our democracy and attempts to move toward a more authoritarian system. It's happening in legislatures that are controlled by Republicans through many states. It's certainly happening at the White House, Bob. Do you agree with Justice Griffin that this constitutes a threat to our democracy, an existential threat?
Yeah, I think you meant Justice Riggs.
Excuse me,
I'm not sure.
Yes.
I'm not sure. Or Judge Griffin would make that categorization. I really do. And again, I keep going back to Justice Deese's dissent because that's coming from a very prominent conservative Republican and others. Ben Ginsburg, who was a lawyer in Bush v. Gore for the Republican side, litigated election cases, did an op-ed in the Carolina Journal, and Governor Pat McCrory. There are a host of Republicans who are sounding this alarm that you are just opening Pandora's box to unsettling every kind of election if this game plan, if this result ends up in saying, well, there's no limitation on challenging election results or challenging rules and laws that were in place during an election. It's just as I think Justice Deeds categorizes it, as election mischief. So in anything that undermines the independent judiciary, whether it's at the national or state level, I think is really undermining democracy in so many different ways. So I think this case has implications way beyond who sits on the North Carolina Supreme Court. Because let's be realistic, if Justice Riggs does retain that seat, it's still a 5-2 Republican majority on the Supreme Court. And if Judge Griffin went on the court, it'd be 6-1. So it doesn't in any way shift the power, which makes you wonder, why are millions of dollars being poured into this and lawyers from all over the country if it didn't have greater implications than just this one seat?
The details on this are arcane and they change almost by the hour, Steve. And I'm wondering if people are talking about this, because this last election seemed to hinge on inflation and bringing prices down. And of course, prices have not come down. They have gone up. We were said to have had the world's best economy prior to the election. We are watching that economy drift away because of decisions being made at the national level. And I'm wondering if people are more concerned about that, tariffs and what that's going to do to their grocery bill and the ability to buy a car versus this. Because Paul Shoemaker, who is a political consultant who is working with Judge Griffin, has indicated that his clients shouldn't be worried about what others think of what these ballot protests and his attempts to reverse the election are doing because, quote, they are more concerned about the economy, crime, education, and the recovery from Hurricane Helene than any case making its way through our courts. Are people talking about this?
I think they are. I think that a lot of people in North Carolina are, I mean, not watching this race. There's so many daily turns of events. I don't think they're following it that close, but I think there's a pretty high awareness of what's happening. And I think people have a real sense are really troubled. Obviously Democrats, I think probably a lot of people in the middle are also really concerned, and some Republicans. You know, going back to the Justice's Dietz's dissent, I think there was an interesting part of it where he wrote that when this case started, I think he wrote something to the effect of, well, I presumed the court would pull back from this. You know, these arguments were made and I thought we would hear it out and I thought we would pull back and not go this far. And I think he wrote that I was wrong. And I think a lot of Democrats, I mean, I remember going back to December when this was all starting to percolate, and a lot of Democrats thought, no, there is no way the Supreme Court could be this brazen and go this far. And I think it has shocked a lot of very cynical and jaded Democrats that it's come to this point.
Bob, I want to go back to something, to Justice Richard Dietz, who you have spoken about several times in this program, and in the ruling from the state Supreme Court in January, he agreed with many of the points that you're agreeing with him on. He said, permitting post-election litigation that seeks to rewrite our state's election rules and as a result remove the right to vote from people who already lawfully voted under the existing rules invites incredible mischief. Is there a loophole here, a legitimate legal loophole? As somebody who sat on that high body in the past, would such a move, making these votes ineligible, be legal under our state constitution, under the United States Constitution, or is this another attempt to thwart and dismiss the rule of law?
Well, I think if the Supreme Court of North Carolina is the final word on election issues in the state, then the decision that just came down modifying in part and affirming in part the Court of Appeals decision is a sweeping decision by the state Supreme Court that we'll have to live with in future elections. Now, we're waiting to see whether the federal courts say, okay, there's some sort of federal issue here, and maybe the U.S. Fourth Circuit, potentially the U.S. Supreme Court could weigh in and make some modification. But I think as a practical matter right now, the decision of the North Carolina Supreme Court, and I have to say procedurally, it was as unusual a procedure as I've seen in 50 years of practicing law. And Justice Dietz says, hey, I thought we were going to hear arguments and have briefs and you know, we would hash this out to the right conclusion. And instead, they just file a 2 or 3 page order that modifies the Court of Appeals decision in several ways. And there was no arguments, no briefing. It was truly astonishing from my perspective in how it happened, not just what happened, but how it happened. And so, I think that's going to be the rule of the case here in North Carolina.
Sam, both sides in this are fighting this tooth and nail, and I'm wondering what the calculus is here and where you stop fighting simply for the common good. Riggs is a former voting rights attorney. You spoke with her. The Guardian has or somebody at the Guardian spoke with her, and she has said that they said that she probably knows election and rules and voting laws in the state better than anyone else. And she said that the other side has chosen the wrong person to pick a fight with because she will not be bullied. I believe it was you, she told. I will not back down from defending the fundamental right to vote. There is no universe in which I yield an inch on this. Griffin has said nothing about this publicly. Do you think he's of the same mindset?
Well, I think like Bob mentioned, you know, there are party interests, you know, fueling the Griffin campaign effort here. I think, you know, Justice Riggs, you know, before she was on the Supreme Court, was probably the most well-known voting rights lawyer in North Carolina. I mean, I think if she wasn't on the court, she would probably be the one litigating this case. And, you know, of all the people to, she told me, of all the people to pick a fight with, she's absolutely the wrong person on this issue. And I think ultimately, you know, they're going to fight every inch of this in federal court until the end. I think ultimately either side, whatever the Fourth Circuit ultimately says, they're going to make an emergency appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, which will, you know, have the final say on this one way or the other. But, you know, like we've talked about a little bit, there are significant federal constitutional issues at play here. You know, a fundamental premise of our democracy is that every voter is treated equally. And, you know, your ballot shouldn't be treated differently if you live in Guilford County or if you live in Orange County. You know, it shouldn't matter what county you live in. The rules are the same for everyone. And I think that, you know, beyond Justice Riggs, you know, having this perspective on the national voting rights landscape, you know, understands that it's very important for federal courts to weigh in very clearly on these types of issues to make it very clear that you can't, that they won't tolerate similar efforts to do similar things in other states.
Bob, I want to get your take on this because Justice Riggs has been very outspoken about this. She's conducted rallies. She's appeared in front of big crowds and she's sounding very much like a politician. And we've played several of those clips over the last several months on this program. Judge Griffin, I don't believe, has commented on this at all. And a spokesman for Judge Griffin recently said that he cannot comment on any issue that is potentially before the court or may come before the court, as quoted in the Code of Judicial Conduct. Both of these individuals sit on courts that are going to be participating and have participated in decisions in this case. Both of those individuals have recused themselves, but they're on those courts. Is she violating the Code of Judicial Conduct by speaking out?
No, I don't think she is. Although I do think this case opens up another Pandora's box about the question of recusal and what constitutes a conflict of interest. And I would say for both courts, the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, it's putting the members of those two courts in an incredibly uncomfortable position, having to make decisions dealing with individuals that they either serve with or may serve with, or some who have campaigned with in elections, or whose spouses have made significant contributions to the campaigns. I mean, it's, you know, that's a whole nother topic is the standards for recusal in these cases. But no, I mean, I think Justice Riggs is pretty cautious in how she articulates her opinions about the merits of this case. I don't think there's anything inherently unethical or wrong about advocating in a piece of litigation in which you are a party.
Steve, I have less than a minute left, and I have to ask. This state Supreme Court is heavily weighted toward Republicans. I think there are five other justices on the court who are Republicans, only two Democrats, of which Alison Riggs is one. The outcome of this would not change the political makeup of this body to any significant degree. Why such a fight when the potential wreckage of confidence in the court is so great here and the benefits are so little? I have 30 seconds.
Good question. Like Justice Orr said earlier, you know, a lot of this is driven by national, but I'll say one more thing. Chief Justice Paul Newby is up for re-election in 2026. That will be, this will probably be a Democratic year. With all of the controversy, he could find himself in a very difficult re-election campaign.
Steve Harrison is WFAE's political reporter, Bob Orr, former justice on the North Carolina State Supreme Court, and Sam Levine, voting rights reporter for The Guardian. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.